I'm going to present basically a summary in some ways of the books of the book or some parts that I find very interesting. And it's always a challenging exercise to summarize a book, Lost in Transplantation: Muslim Marriage in Western Courts. And I must say, I have been fascinated for a number of years now, fascinated by the relationship between religion and secularism, but in particular, how religious claims are being articulated, translated, received, and distorted by Western courts in what I would describe as an explosive encounter, especially when it involves women. And I have decided in this book to take one specific legal institution from Islamic law called the mahr, so part of the marriage contract, and to follow the ways in which this institution travels to Canada, the US, France, and Germany. So I will take you to this journey with me. And I will start with the point of departure. So first, this is my first slide here, what is mahr? And then we'll go to the journey to Western courts. So first, mahr is the gift that the Muslim husband gives to his wife at the time of marriage. But it is often, if not always, divided into two parts, what we called prompt mahr, so a very symbolic amount of money, often $1 at the time of marriage, and a big amount of money deferred upon death or divorce. But not all types of divorce. Three types of divorce under Islamic law: the talaq, the hul divorce, and the fasq divorce. So the first, the talaq, what we know as la répudiation, repudiation. So the husband will say talaq, talaq, talaq three times. But upon the third talaq, he must have the amount of money of deferred mahr in his hand, ready to deliver to his wife. So if she was really smart, she'd probably bargain a really high amount, let's imagine £50,000, so that it's unlikely that one morning he will say talak, 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 and have the amount of money in his hands. The second type of divorce, the hul divorce, is a type of divorce initiated by the wife, but with the understanding that she will waive deferred mahr. So part of the cost-benefit analysis goes as follows. She will think, okay, upon divorce, I will not get alimony, only alimony for my kids, maintenance for a maximum of 3 months, which is called in Islamic law the iddah period, no division of assets, and I will have to waive my £50,000. So economically, not very interesting, but it is possible for her still to obtain this divorce. My current research project, as Marcus was mentioning, involves also Jewish law. Under Jewish law, the Jewish woman cannot get divorced, period. So the Muslim wife here has some options, but some of these options are costly. So this is an example, the hul divorce. The third type of divorce, it is called the fasq divorce. It is what we know in Western law, Western family law, as a fault-based divorce, initiated by the wife, and she will keep the deferred mahr. So this is an interesting divorce, but she has to go to court and show that her case meets the very limited circumstances offered by the legal system. So her husband disappeared, he's in jail, he was violent, she has witnesses. So women can try this route. It is the most promising route, but it is difficult to obtain. So this is the kind of classical religious law understanding of mahr. And now I really like this slide because it represents three of my main arguments. So the first one, imagine this pie here where you see Tunisia, Malaysia, and Egypt as a ball. And this is mahr, and I'm throwing mahr to Canada, the US, France, and Germany. And you see that the legal transplant, mahr as a legal transplant, involves different interpretations coming from different countries. So let's say that I'm a judge in Canada. It might be that the couple, the husband and wife, one is from Tunisia and the other one is from Malaysia. Actually, they have two different understandings of mahr. So as a judge, how are you supposed to receive the translation of religious law in secular courts? It gets very, very complicated. And I'll tell you a little bit more in a second. So my first argument is that the legal transplant itself, if you take this ball, mahr, and you throw it, Canada, US, France, and Germany, the place of departure is complex, and we will see this here. It is not homogeneous. It is not uniform. It involves different legal systems, so difficult to understand from the perspective of the judge. Second argument, one would expect that the translation of Mar follows national lines. So a comparative law scholar would say, oh, there's probably a Canadian way of doing things, a French way, attached to laïcité, for instance, a German way, an American way. Well, I studied, I hope, all cases involving the adjudication of Mar in these four countries, and I could not make these four piles. And I tried. I tried to put all the Canadian cases, and they all said different things. And I had my American cases, and the French one, and the German one. And it took me weeks to actually decide to map them, not according to national systems, but according to ideological camps. So I came up with three different categories, the first one being legal pluralism, the second, formal equality, the third, substantive equality. So that's my second big finding. Judges don't really like that when I say this, that law cannot produce logically. You cannot predict what a legal system would bring in terms of outcomes. So I have my three ideological camps. And my third point is that each camp can quite logically produce both the enforcement and the non-enforcement of Mar. So this is fascinating, I find. So I will take you through this wonderful journey. The first point of departure, Mar, as I was explaining, you can imagine that you have, especially in this era of globalization, you can have one, the husband can be from Malaysia and the wife from Tunisia, but maybe they have been there for a while, let's say in Canada, maybe the wife from Tunisia, maybe her father was from Egypt, right? So let's imagine that in 50 years, it can get pretty complex, right? And just to give you a very, very quick presentation, Tunisia was highly influenced by the colonial presence of France. The legal system is very influenced by this presence, especially the adoption in 1956 of what we call le code du statut personnel, so personal status law is very, very secular. So for instance, my previous slide here, forget about this. You're in Tunisia, no talak, no khul, no fask. But you're in Tunisia. But still, Mar is part of every marriage contract, but it's a symbolic Mar. So $2 deferred, you know, $1 at the time of marriage and $1 deferred Mar. When you move to Egypt, a country influenced by French law and English law, you will have this slide, talak, khul, fast divorce. The fast divorce is almost impossible. It takes months, it's very costly. So many women decide upon divorce when they really want to get divorced to go with the khul divorce, but it's costly for them. And the recent empirical data shows that women after divorce are in poverty, and they only get a limited alimony for their children. In Malaysia, influenced by legal system is influenced by English law, and adat, which is customary law, coming from the presence of indigenous people. It's very interesting, this kind of the hybrid nature of the legal system. You will also have the khul fask here, the slide, but interestingly enough, the talak, the wife can go to court and ask to have a form of talak as well. Mar is usually low, not because we are in Tunisia and there's the influence of the French system, but it is low because there's also a different type of Mar called Pemberian, which is coming. Oh, I see that. This is fun. I have people that probably come from this country. Influenced by customary law, influenced by indigenous law. So this is very complex, right? Imagine that you're a judge and you just don't know anything about Islamic law. And I say that because I gave training to judges and they say to me, like, forget about this place of departure. We don't even know what the word Mar means, right? So it is very, very complex for these judges to know what to do. So now we're moving to Canada, the US, France, and Germany. And this is the law in books. This is what you learn when you're a student of comparative law. You will be told that in Canada and the US, it is the law of residence that applies in family law matters. So even if you don't have the citizenship, you've been living in Canada, you get divorced, Canadian law. this is oversimplistic, but just to give you a picture. Whereas in France and Germany, it will be the law of citizenship. By the way, women do not know this, what I'm telling you. So you stay in Germany for 10 years, you stay in France for 10 years. We know that it's difficult to obtain the citizenship, German citizenship, French citizenship. So you stay there for 10 years, you get divorced, you go to the German judge and you say, I'm ready to get divorced. The judge will ask you as a first question, you live in Germany, I understand that you're a resident of this country. Do you have the citizenship? Oh no, you don't. You're from Iran, your citizenship is from Iran? Wonderful, we're gonna apply Iranian law. So the judge, the German judge, will actually become an Iranian scholar, which is scary, right? So he will become an Iranian scholar, he will apply Iranian Islamic law, not knowing what it is, but he will apply it, unless he concludes that it violates public order. This is the only little window. If he concludes that applying Islamic laws against public order, which is a difficult test, right? It has to be pretty bad. But otherwise, he will apply the law of citizenship, Iranian Islamic law, for instance. So this is what we learn in comparative law. My claim is that it does not help us to know this necessarily, because judges, first of all, are lost, and we can understand why, but they will translate Mar according to these three categories. So I will explain my categories. And I changed the wording so many times throughout these weeks of work. The legal pluralist understanding of Mar is the kind of typical multiculturalist understanding. So the judge will study Mar and will probably really like the idea that an imam comes to court to explain to him. Because for him, Mar is religious. It has been concluded in the context of a religious ceremony, it's related to religion and so on. So he will ask an imam to come to the courtroom, or the parties will suggest this, and he will give a big, big importance to the testimony of the imam. It's not always a good idea for the women. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, and I will explain what this means. The second category, the formal equality, the judge will see Mar as a contract. There's an amount of money, and will apply contract law questions. Was there consent, consideration, any duress? And the judge will exclude any religious testimony because it is a contract. It can be called Mar. It could be called anything else, right? It's an amount of money, two persons involved, and this is how it is being understood. The third category, the substantive equality, the judge will view it in terms of gender. Will think, well, no, it's not just like any contract. It involves women, and it has an effect on women. And it's not just about religion. It has a disproportionate impact on women, and will view it through these lens. Now, my third argument, remember, was each category can quite logically produce both the enforcement and the non-enforcement of Mar. So here on my left side, I have the enforcement and the different boxes in law. We love boxes and categories. And on the right, we have the non-enforcement of Mar. So here's how it goes. And please notice that in my three categories, you can find Canada, the US, France, and Germany. They are everywhere. It's like a circle like this. So the legal pluralist, as I said, will welcome the imam in the courtroom and will attach Mar to an Islamic custom, identity, religious freedom, and so on, right? The different boxes legally. Or we'll come to the conclusion, actually, that the judge should not enforce Mar because this is utterly foreign. So I have this case in mind, very interesting case in Canada, Kadoura versus Hamoud. The judge, after hearing three different imams who said three different things about Mar, said, hold on, I don't have the expertise to decide this case. I don't have jurisdiction. This was the conclusion. The judge said, I don't have jurisdiction. I am not Muslim. I have three imams who say three different things. Thank you. Bye-bye. The amount of money of Mar will be zero. Basically, the message is, why don't you go to your imam and, you know, you guys figure it out, because this is really too complex. But the judge was attached, right? Was really willing to welcome the imam and several imams, but just decided that this was impossible. The formal equality, as I said, the judge will exclude religious experts. And these are the boxes. So in the US, antenuptial agreement. In Canada, marriage contract. In Germany, legal debt. In France, contractual condition of marriage. And will enforce the amount. So the wife says, my Mar is £50,000. Yes, marriage agreement, contractual condition of marriage, and so on. These are the boxes. Or the judge comes to the conclusion that this is too vague, this is too abstract. There's a lack of consent, the wife did not understand what it involved, and so on, and decides not to enforce it on that basis. Third category, the substantive equality, gender. I find this category fascinating. When it is being enforced, sometimes judges decided to enforce it, but looked at the amount and thought, £5,000? No, not enough. I will change the amount of money, make it higher. This is going to be like alimony, but a higher amount of money. So quite interesting in the kind of distortion of religious claims, right? The judge takes the liberty to enforce an Islamic custom, but change the amount, which makes it something else. So it mar in the travel, in the journey, becomes alimony, but a different amount of money. Or, this is the other four boxes, the judge comes to the conclusion that mar, against public policy, against substantial justice, against equity, unjust enrichment. So looks at the notion, the definition of mar, and sees it through the lens of women and comes to the conclusion that this is not an equitable or a very fair institution for women and therefore should not enforce it. Now, I am interested now, so far I have presented to you the perspective of the legal system from the adjudicators, from the judges, from the courtroom, and I want to now bring you back to what is being argued by the parties. And I'm using this slide in a really provocative way. I'm taking one key text of American realism written by Holmes called The Path of the Law, and Holmes later became quite a famous judge at the Supreme Court, the American Supreme Court. And he wrote this piece called The Path of the Law, and he used, developed his theory of what is called the bad man theory. But the bad man is not bad morally. The bad man is the strategic guy that will try to get the best outcome from the courtroom, right? And is not interested in any ethical consequences, but in the material consequences. How best to argue your case if you want to get X amount of money, right? That's the bad man theory presented by Holmes. So I'm trying to see if religion is being presented by parties in all kinds of distorted way in order, if you're the woman, to get the amount of money, and if you're the man, not to pay the amount of money. And it so happens that it is. So I will present to you how this is being argued. This is the typical, and then I'll break down the cases, but this is the typical argumentation. So the bad man, the Muslim husband, he is going to court. He does not want to pay mahr. And he will find all kinds of arguments not to pay mahr. In most cases, he will say, objection, Your Honor, you do not have jurisdiction, right? Remember my case that I presented before. I am a religious man. This is a religious institution. You do not have the expertise. You should leave this to our own people. You should leave this to the imams. You do not have the expertise to decide these issues, which involves, by the way, that he's not going to pay any amount of money. But let's put that aside. But, and this is fascinating to me as a finding, but the man will say, I don't want to pay mahr. This is too religious for you. But my wife is quite rich, and you know what? I'm interested in alimony. I think she should pay alimony for me. The 50-50 division, I really like that. So why don't I get alimony, but you don't enforce mahr because this is too religious. This couch that she bought, really like this couch. So the husband is taking this kind of very complex position of arguing on the one hand for amount of money, right? So he's not too religious to get the couch and the alimony, but he's too religious for the man. And the woman is equally the bad woman, right? She really wants to get the maximum amount of money. So this is her strategy. Mahr is a contract. Mahr is not religious. Your Honor, this is very easy. This is an easy case. This is a contract. Just enforce it and give me the amount of money. But however, if she sees that it would be much more interesting to have the 50-50 divide, and remember my rule about France and Germany, for instance, it would be a good argumentation to say this is against public order, right? Mar is against public order. It is the sale of the vagina. So I'm saying what I, you know, this is what I read in cases. Mar is like the sale of the vagina. I had to accept this degrading institution. But by the way, if you do the 50-50 division, I will probably get £300,000 or something. So you understand where I'm coming from. So the woman will argue whatever will get her the maximal economic benefits. Interestingly, in many cases, when the husband said, well, she's asking for a divorce, which is a whole divorce, therefore she should waive Mar. This is, for Muslim women, this is an interesting question, right? Because if you are in Iran, and if you are in Morocco, and if you are in Egypt, and if you, when you ask the divorce, the whole divorce, you know that you are supposed to waive Mar, right? But now you're in Canada, the US, France, and Germany. How are you supposed to adjudicate this, right? So when the woman is faced with this question, in these cases, she says, oh, really? I've never heard of this. The waiver, never heard of the waiver. So this is part of the cases. Or the woman says, well, I've heard of the waiver, but I thought it was only if I cheated on him, and I didn't. I can show you, Your Honor, I really didn't cheat on him. So we get interesting construction of Islamic law that do not match the book on both parties. Now, my other move here is to apply a kind of left-line economic approach to these issues to see what are the costs and the benefits. When Mar is being enforced, is it a bonus to the wife or is it a penalty? So my findings, and I constructed personages here, my Lailas, I call them Lailas, and I will present to you how Mar, the enforcement of Mar can both be a penalty to the wife and a bonus, or a bonus, and the non-enforcement can be a penalty or a bonus. And my four Lailas here, they all match cases. I'm not inventing anything. But to make it more sexy and colorful, I base them on stories, political figures, writers, singers. So I have taken, you know, to make it more fun. So let's start with this image here. Obviously, Benazir Bhutto was a very strong woman. Her writings are quite strong. She is a religious person, but would recreate a very feminist understanding of Islamic law. And I will present to you this first woman. My Laila here is strong. She decided at the time of marriage to include all kind of really great clauses in her marriage contract, such as, remember my first slide? She doesn't want talak, no khul, no fask, high mar. So she, you know, she's got everything. No polygamy. She's being paid for breastfeeding, which has roots in Islamic law. So she's got the best possible marriage contract that you cannot imagine. And she would actually get more than a non-Muslim woman who would get a 50-50, because she does not have all these divorces, but on top she has Mar and so on. So this is a great contract. She's pretty confident that she will go to court if she has to go one day upon divorce and get a really sweet deal. Here's her surprise. She goes to court. This is a decision from Canada, by the way. She goes to court and she takes the marriage contract and she says, Your Honor, this is very easy. I have included everything. You just have to read it and just, you know, give me Mar and read this contract. And the judge says, well, this is Islamic law. I need an imam and so on. So the judge invites an imam who basically says, the only question that matters here is she the one asking for divorce? Oh, whole divorce. Yes. She's the one asking for divorce. She has to waive this £50,000 or dollars. And so she left the courtroom with zero. Mar was zero because the judge believed the imam and said, we have to apply the whole divorce, and the whole divorce entails a waiver of mahr. So although she felt she was very well protected legally, the distortion, you see, came from the expert witness who actually took a central position in the case. So the non-enforcement of mahr was here a penalty for the wife and a bonus for the husband, who was pretty happy about this, right? So here, Irshad Manji, very well-known, very loud, very colorful, very, I don't know how to describe her, wrote the book The Trouble with Islam, translated in I don't know how many languages, right? And it's Irshad Manji, and I, you know, tried to match a little bit my story with her own story. So this is a situation where Mailala is married, and one day says to her husband, "I am gay. I'm lesbian. I'm coming out of the closet." He says, "Talak, talak, talak." Right? Thank you. Talak, talak, talak. But decides not to give mahr because he's angry. Right? You were hiding your sexual orientation. I take the liberty of giving the talak, but not the mahr. She goes to court. She says, "Fine, interesting. I'm gonna fight pretty hard for my rights here." She goes to court, and she convinces the judge that she should get mahr because she's Muslim and it's religious identity and freedom of religion and multiculturalism and so on. She should get mahr plus alimony for herself plus 50-50 division of assets plus. So she leaves the courtroom with such a sweet deal, and again, a deal that me, myself, could never get, right? So mahr is not a mahr is like a separate part of the decision. It's about multiculturalism and freedom of religion, and the rest is also applied alimony 50. Are you following me? So this is the best possible deal, and it's a really huge penalty for the husband, right? Because this is an outcome that that he would never face in any Muslim country. And any non-Muslim man would never be faced with this in any Western country. My third Laila, my German secular young professional rising star, she is rich, secular doctor. She has mahr in her marriage contract. She's married to a taxi driver. And she decides to get divorced, and she's trying to convince the court that she should get mahr. The judge comes to the conclusion that actually it would be an unjust enrichment. In these circumstances, the judge has to apply the law of citizenship, which is here Iranian law, and it would be really unjust even if you apply only mahr and no alimony and no division of assets. She's so rich, right, that it would be unjust to enforce mahr in these circumstances. So her initial contract, although private international law rules, conflict of laws are being applied, she will not get mahr because of the unjust nature of such an outcome. My third Laila here, from Malaysia, a French resident, this is the story that I presented before, the kind of window of public order. And I find the language here very interesting, how women, in order to avoid private international law rules, to avoid this law of citizenship, will do everything to convince the court that this is the ultimate discrimination against women. Mars, again, remember the sale of the vagina. Women all over the world try to fight against this institution of mahr and so on. And they try to convince the Western court that if we want to integrate these immigrants, we have to really fight hard against discrimination against women. And this is the big, big window. I find it fascinating because it would often be a kind of language that would be described as racist in other circumstances, but it's used by the parties themselves to get a maximal economic outcome. So in a conclusion here, this is my transplant and how it travels. So we're starting from a place of departure, a very complex place of departure. I just gave you three examples: Tunisia, Malaysia, Egypt, but we could add Morocco and Saudi Arabia, and we would get places of departure that are very, very complex and difficult to understand, even coming from each legal system. But we have spouses who are married to one another and start from this place of departure. Then you get to Canada, the US, France, and Germany, and it is being received according to these three camps. And as I said, each camp will produce, quite logically, the non-enforcement or the enforcement of MAR, and each outcome can be a bonus or a penalty for the wife or for the husband. So I guess the conclusion is that it is very messy, and it allows for strategic, I guess, argumentations on a legal perspective for the parties. And I was so, at the end of this book, I was so, the one thing that was missing, I found, was meeting these women, right? Because you only have limited stories through case law. So my current research project that Marcus just introduced involves interviews with women. Interviews with women in France, in Germany, in the UK, in Canada, to understand how do they navigate between the religious and the secular spheres? Because we only get part of the story partly right. And everything that is in the shadow of secular law, we just don't know, right? So it's not part of the cases. And this is what is missing from these stories. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And I'm happy to have a family law expert. This is wonderful.
Professor Fugny. We would like to invite questions. If you have questions, yes, please. Maybe briefly identify yourself and, and then pose your question.
No, this is a great question. As I was saying before, so in Canada, the National Judicial Institute, which is the big institute for, you know, judges coming from different provinces in Canada, they realized that we have to do something about this, right? Because judges don't have the tools to even ask questions. So they started to give training on religious law years ago. And I was involved in these trainings, and I'm still every year or so giving some training. And one of my big fascination, judges will not be interested in where the parties are coming from, but they see Islamic law as religious law, as Quran, Prophet Muhammad. I mean, this is the kind of, right? And even this window is complex, right? Because as you say, you can have different schools, Maliki, Hanafi, and you can have, part of the Quran and then the Hadith say something. So just this window is very difficult for them to understand. So if on top of this you say, yes, this is the window of what Prophet Muhammad has said and the Quran and the schools, but also they come from Tunisia, this becomes too complicated. And I think they often make the mistake of relying on a religious expert, this imam, who will not say where he's coming from, I mean, for him, this is not relevant, right? He's talking on behalf of, you know, he's le porte-parole, right? He will talk, try to translate what the Quran and Prophet Muhammad would have said. I mean, this is the kind of testimony that the imam will give. And unfortunately, but I understand at the same time why judges are reluctant to open different windows, because where does it end, right? If you say, well, okay, I know what the Quran says and the Hadith and Prophet Muhammad, and she's from Malaysia and she's from Tunisia, I mean, how can then we do anything? Then we the judges, are almost tempted to say, oh, lack of jurisdiction. I don't think we have the expertise to decide these issues. So it is a very difficult dilemma, with no perfect solution, unfortunately, because again, and for that reason, the secular kind of formal equality, when judges say, oh, I'm excluding all these witnesses, this is going to be just a contract, and it is not relevant whether it's religious or not. I think this is why it's very attractive. I'm not saying it's the right approach, but it's attractive for a judge because it allows some certainty, right? You can say, well, I'm going to apply contract law. Questions, consent, consideration, duress, no duress, okay, this is the amount of money. And there, we are lost, this is part of my title, lost in transplantation, because Mar is religious. Mar was not just any contract. But probably the difficulty, and in the years to come, where will it end, right? So the real question is, when the parties concluded this marriage contract, if the spouses are from different countries with different understanding of Mar, how do we resolve these issues? Do you ask questions like, when did you arrive in Canada? You arrived 10 years ago. Oh, for you it was 15 years. How do you apply these notions, right? Do you see where I'm going? It is very, very difficult. But from what I have seen, the imam as the expert witness, not always the best idea. Yeah, not always the best idea. It's unfortunate that we don't have more of, you know, like a list of different experts that you could choose. It's often quite limited, the pool.
So can I just
ask yes, yes, yes. Most of my cases, except with the exception of a few, but most of them, for reasons that I don't know, have not been appealed. I don't know if it's because it was too costly. I don't know what the reasons are. I know that the Supreme Court decisions in Canada, the recent Supreme Court decisions involving religion and women, involve Jewish law. Judges more and more are going in a direction of what we call in Canada a subjective interpretation of freedom of religion, not an objective one, because of this difficulty. Because, you know, you have three rabbis who say three different things. How are you supposed to choose which witness says the right thing? This is a very difficult dilemma, and judges decided to go the Supreme Court in that direction of listening to the parties and the subjective interpretation and trying to make up their mind as to who we should believe, which, you know, poses another challenge. But it's very problematic, the use of expert witnesses.
Yes, yeah. One here.
So thank you very much. It was really very interesting to me. And I actually have, like, plenty of questions, but I'll try to limit myself to one.
Tell us who you are.
But this comes with many problems for women,
honestly,
also, yeah.
Yeah, that's very problematic.
Yeah.
You just said that you don't have these many possibilities, so some places are limited. So
right.
I'm just wondering, why do they accept that? And also for the Jewish aspect, like women, Jewish women in those countries, do they even have the right to claim divorce? I mean, if they got married in Jewish matrimony in Israel, could they ask for get?
Yeah, okay, this is a great question. You have to stop there. No. Give me more questions, but I'm just right. I don't want to forget my thought. Yeah, no, great.
Okay, no,
more?
I'll stop there because then again.
Okay. And then we can go back to. So your first question here, this is my answer here is, I was presenting recently in Spain, actually, and there was a judge from Spain and judges from different civil law jurisdiction who would say, I ask exactly this question. You know, this system of private international law, conflict of laws, which involves that a foreigner is a foreigner forever, right? Like, unless you have the citizenship. So imagine this woman, and it actually happened. She left Iran precisely because she didn't like the system, right? She was not a great fan of Khomeini. And she gets to Germany, and we say, oh, you have the Iranian citizenship? We're going to apply this here. So what the answer to that is, I think this system has to be radically reformed. Okay, it was good at a time when we did not have many immigrants, right? And this was the kind of philosophy behind it, is we actually want to respect you because we don't have many immigrants, and you come from this country, and we don't want you to suddenly be lost, right? Like, you just arrived in Germany, and we say to you, oh, we don't care that, you know, you were married in this country, or you have the citizenship, and so on. We will want to respect your culture. But nowadays, with the number of immigrants, right, who you know, are residents forever in France and Germany, it's very difficult to obtain the citizenship. Legal scholars are aware that this can no longer be sustained, but are at the same time reluctant to just go in the direction of law of residence. So this would be part of my answer. The other question, I started my project on the Jewish get. The interviews in Canada were completed, and I also did interviews in Israel, actually. And it is quite, again, the same messiness exists, because in Canada, you cannot, if you apply rabbinical law, if you apply religious law, you cannot force a man to give the get, because then the get is coerced, and then it's not valid, right? So we are placed in an impossible situation. The only thing that Jewish women can do, and I must say that this decision from the Supreme Court of Canada called the Markowitz-Bruker decision was written by a Jewish feminist woman, Justice Abala, and I think it's the only reason why we have what I would say is a great decision with a dissent. In that decision, she came to the conclusion that we could actually give damages to the women if the man, as he did in that case, waited to give the get until she was like 45 and couldn't have kids anymore. So he waited all these years, I think in that case it was 13 years, before giving the get in order for her not to, you know, have kids and so on. So in the Court of Appeal, that was in Quebec, the Court of Appeal was so afraid to intervene, right? So the Court of Appeal said, this is too religious. Remember my argument of lack of jurisdiction? They actually applied my case about Damar, the Kadura decision, the Court of Appeal. They said, oh, this is just like Damar. This is too religious, lack of jurisdiction, the rabbis should decide, we cannot do anything. And it went up to the Supreme Court, and she convinced the court that this is a way for us. But we cannot force a man to give the get, but we can give damages, which is not ideal, but it's better than nothing. So this is, and the situation, I must say, in Israel is fascinating. My research project involves women who have actually used the sanction law and have sent men to jail for refusing to give them the get. And I'm interested in this relationship between criminal law and family law. And the relationship between criminal law and family law exists in other encounters. Polygamy, we have a big debate currently in Canada. So polygamy, family law, it's in the criminal code. Anal intercourse, still in the criminal code in Canada. It's not enforced, but it's still there. So it's, you know, how family law just migrates to criminal law. I find it fascinating. And the impact that it has on women often.